listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
My name is Denton Sinkelgrana. I'm Chief Oil Analyst at Opus, a Dow Jones company, and I'm going to let my co-host introduce himself right now.
I am Brandon Gormley, and I am the Executive Director of Retail Software Sales and Client Success here at Opus.
We're lucky today bringing in a titan here, in my opinion, Alan Meyer of Meyer Oil and Mach 1. So Mach 1 is a family-owned and operated chain of convenience stores, 17 locations and growing, with locations throughout Illinois and Indiana. Mach 1 strives to provide a clean, friendly environment, quality products, competitive prices, and meet their customers' needs. And really, you know, kind of the customer is their top priority. So, Alan, want to welcome you to the podcast. You've been a friend of Opus for a long time, so it's a pleasure to have you and have a conversation here with you once again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Dan.
One of the things that I noticed when I was doing some research is how much the customer focus and customer service continued to come up, whether it be on your website or whether it be on any sort of profile that I've seen. And I was wondering if you could kind of dive into a little bit of that and how that becomes your key to success, and your strategies are sort of built around that.
So I agree with you, Brandon. That is the messaging and the culture that we try to create in our company. You know, when we talk internally with our operations team, our marketing team, you know, what I like to say is with all the consolidation in our industry, you know, there's some very large players out here and we can't compete with them on scale because, you know, their buying power, their national awareness, we're not going to be able to compete with that with our 25 stores. But what we can compete is store level execution. I always start off the message. I guess let me say this. Every store manager into our company, I interview before we hire. And one of the messages I always deliver in that interview is we are a family owned business. And I take a lot of pride in that. And family owned business is, you know, a statement in the sense that it was started by my dad and my uncle, and now we're into our generation, but it's really a mindset and a culture. You know, what I always say is you come on board with us and you're going to have my cell phone number in your phone. And, you know, if you have a problem and you need to talk to me, that can, no matter what time of day, no matter what day of the week, it is not only okay for you to call me, the expectation is for you to call me because we're in this together. When you talk about customer focus, we are able to get a lot more granular store by store when you're dealing with problems of 25 stores than when you're dealing with problems of hundreds or even thousands of stores. So if you do have a customer issue that may not have the ability to rise to the level of key decision makers of large companies, you know, I have the opportunity to be a part of that conversation. And then, you know, it's all about teamwork. Let's together figure out the best path forward, whether that's dealing with customer issues, whether that's dealing with new marketing plans, so on and so forth. It's almost everything done in our company is done by a group think. We all have the opportunity to kind of voice our opinions. But then once we've done that, then we are pick a path forward and we are all unified in figuring out going down that path. Secondarily on that, we don't have the scale again, but at 25 stores, what I like to tell people is that we have 25 very, very successful stores. So when you're talking about, you know, signing up for software for social media, when you're doing data analysis, you know, software as a service has, you know, taken over basically all so much of our operational costs. So, you know, you're paying at a per store cost. Well, every one of our stores, we're not worried about getting a store into the black. It's about maximizing the profits and the sales and the profits of where it's at. It's not about becoming profitable. It's about maximizing that profit. So budgetary conversations are usually fairly easy because we're not trying to justify an expense onto a mediocre or less than mediocre site. It's all about, does this make sense for us as a company? So money rarely comes into the conversation. It's all about investment.
That sounds awesome, Alan. And you obviously hear a lot of companies say, oh, we always put the customer first. We always put the customer first. But it's so refreshing to hear what you guys are actually talking about, you're actually putting into action. So just to confirm, did I hear that right? So every store manager, you actually interview yourself?
I interview every store manager and a part of that hiring process. And then once we've hired them, I text them my cell phone number and said, basically the message I just said, you call me if you can't get a hold of somebody, or if you need something, you call me anytime, day or night.
That's awesome. So, you know, the strategy around, you know, sort of keeping the customer in focus, you know, you're really starting with your employees, making sure that they have everything that they need so that their time, attention, and focus and energy is with the customer from the time that they start until the time that they clock out.
Yeah. You know, Mach 1, we're a bottom up company. What I always say is the person that is standing on the other side of that counter and greeting our customers, that is the most important person at that store at that moment in time. The most important level in our company is GM. So when I hire these store managers, we call them general managers. When we hire these general managers, I look at them and say, you know, for any specific market, I'm not the face of Mach 1. You're the face of Mach 1. When our employees go home and their wife says, hey, how was your day at work? They're thinking of you. They're not thinking of me. Their relationship to you is determining how well they think of their job. And then when the people in our markets talk about the people at Mach 1, they're not talking about me. I live in Effingham, Illinois. They're talking about you and the people that you hire, that you develop, and the culture that you've created, because this is your store. And so you're the most important level in our company. So every single person in our company is here to support you to maximize your success, because your success is the company's success.
We talk a lot about, you know, customers and, you know, kind of keeping them in focus. And really, a lot of times the objective there is to generate loyalty, right? So that guest has, you know, a really great experience, and part of their decision, you know, when they decide where they're going to get fuel or where they're going to get the Gatorade on the way to soccer practice is going to be Mach 1, right? There's no other option. I'm going to go to Mach 1 because that is the place to go. How else are you guys thinking about loyalty? I know, you know, loyalty programs right now are really trendy. There's a lot of mobile apps. There's technology out there to engage with customers. How are you guys thinking about that?
Yeah, we've had a loyalty program since 2014, so we've had it for 10 years. Back then, it was just kind of getting off the ground. You know, Starbucks, you saw other industries getting into it. The C-store industry, Speedway, was obviously a market leader for loyalty. You know, back then, I thought it was hard, but I think it's, looking back on now, I think it was relatively easy. Really, you just created a loyalty program, handed cards into people's hands, and I think people just, you know, saw, hey, I'm on the Mach 1 loyalty program, and you generated real value just in the sheer fact that it was just a program, not even getting into the details of what that program actually was. People have become a lot smarter about that. You know, you have to generate real value in a loyalty program to keep people get engaged into your loyalty program. And this is all coming at a time where operational costs have continued to go up and will continue to go up. So, you know, you have to be conscientious of margin, but still provide real value in a loyalty program. Now it's not just a broadcast, hey, you get on this loyalty program, everybody gets XYZ. You really got to be digging into the data and doing targeted promotions to give people something of value that they're going to use, but then still allow you to maintain overall profitability of your company, of that store.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. In the first episode on Opus Talks, Denton and I spent a little bit of time just talking about data and how important data is.
I'm a big fan of data, Brandon.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost hard not to be at this point. But where's the strategy with Mach 1 and and understanding how much investment do you put in the analysis of the data, right? And how much you're tracking transaction logs and merchandise sales and fuel sales. And now the loyalty program, how does that all sort of get tied together so that you make sense of it, so that you can sort of continue to steer the ship in the right direction?
Well, that's a great question, Brandon. And that answer is constantly evolving. So, you know, what I kind of share with people is, you know, 7-8 years ago, the goal was to get access to the data. You know, we'd have these transaction journals. They'd get onto a hard drive at the store. It may be dump into your back office software, and you were looking at department level sales, high level wage costs. You know, you're really kind of looking at a P&L, but not really item level data. So, you know, I made a hard quest to try to get to transaction analysis like you're talking about. And I could list off 7 companies I'm working with right now, Opus being one of them, about getting data and how to utilize it. There is no shortage of options to get data today. And to me, when I talk to people in my industry, especially a next generation person that's trying to kind of gain his footing and kind of where to focus on. And I'm always a big believer in, you don't know where to go until you know where you're at. And data is the only way to do it. Nothing frustrates me more when operational people, GMs, they'll sit there and say, well, last Tuesday I was at this store and this customer said X. Well, that is one customer, one moment in time, one store. We're averaging 1,200 people a day in all these stores times 23. So while I want to hear those things, a one-time instance, we shouldn't be guiding the direction of our company based off of one instance at one store at one moment in time. So I'm working with Opus on market share data. And I don't know how much you guys want to get into any of this, but Opus with market share data. I'm working with a company called Tega on transaction level data. I've got my loyalty company with Ignite and their data. I'm also working with a company called InStore AI on audio. So we were recording the audio at the checkouts at all of our stores, and it's dumping into customer service execution. The problem today isn't access to data. It is the time. Paying the software companies what we're paying is not the large source of this cost. It is, you know, if you're going to have it, someone's got to go through it, and then you have to create action items off of it. Otherwise, why did you get it to begin with? I guess the best way to say it is it's kind of an ever-evolving structure of how much time to dedicate to any one of these things. Right now, from transaction analysis, we do a quarterly meeting to basically start at the 10,000 foot view and drill down. That at the same time in that quarterly meeting, we do that with your market share data and how we're performing relative to the market and drill down. And then we use the customer service. So we kind of go through those things on a quarterly basis with our operational people. I probably spend 10 to 20% of my time in a week going over this same data to try to look for outliers to see what needs to be addressed.
My big takeaway, Alan, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that, you know, although the anecdotal data points are important, right? You want to hear about the experience. You want to hear about, you know, those little blips in time. Creating strategies and becoming more data driven is not a bad place to be in right now. And to your point, there's so many data sources out there and so many different angles, slices and dices to take a look at your information to sort of try to make sense of it all. You know, it's really that open-mindedness, right? It's like, hey, we're not as good as we could be. You know, we always want to try to strive to be better for our customer. And let's take a look at the data. If someone has something interesting to share, let's take a look at it, evaluate if it has any value. And if it does, let's consider it like as part of our strategy.
I couldn't have said it better, Brandon. You know, you look at the major consolidators in the industry, they've got entire departments of folks, entire rooms of people that are analyzing this data. And they're writing their own software and writing it specific to what they're wanting and how they want to utilize it. the first step is getting access to the data. If you don't accept that you need to improve, that you are falling behind, because if you're not improving, you're falling behind, because our competitors are improving every day. Software and technology has made it easier to improve today than it ever has in this industry's history. So you acknowledging that you need to be better tomorrow than you are today, and you need to figure out what tools you want to use to accomplish that. That, to me, that's step one. Then it's obviously getting that data and talking to the software companies that get it to you. And my message is always to them is, you know, this data is great, and I'd like to go through it and try to identify weak points and opportunities. But it'd be better if you could point out weak points and opportunities for me. And so I'm not trying to find them myself. I'm addressing what you found. You know, to me, that's the utopia of data.
That's excellent. And, you know, that mentality of continuing to improve, looking over your shoulder about like what your competition's doing, trying to keep the customer in mind. You guys are constantly looking for different formats of stores. You're adding different offerings here or there. Prior to the podcast, Denton had mentioned to me around the truck stop model that you guys have. So Denton could speak to this more so than I could, because he's more familiar with it. But Denton and Alan, you know, talk to us about what Mach 1 has in store for truck stops.
Yeah, it's a pretty new adventure for you, Alan. So yeah, would love to hear more about, you know, well, why truck stops?
We remodeled a gas station into a truck stop in 2017, roughly. And honestly, before that, we kind of thought that the major players in the truck stop industry kind of had taken that entire market, and there really wasn't room for little guys like us. So we never really seriously considered it. You know, this is specific to the state of Illinois, but video gaming came into our state and created some opportunities around gas stations, but specifically truck stops. And so we got into the truck stop business because of video gaming, but we figured out that this was an untapped market, that very similar to the C-store industry, you've got your big guys, the guys that have hundreds and thousands of stores that are mapped out all over the world. But if you can do store level execution at the truck stop level for that trucking customer, he's going to create a real loyalty to you than he is to the national players. Because I can tell you any one of those is way more valuable to me than they are to those national players. I need that customer base. So we didn't as a company realize the potential of what truck stops were going to be, quickly realized it shortly after that. Operated that for a couple years, and I think we fine-tuned a lot of issues, and I can get into that in a second, but said, hey, we think we might have a business model here. So we built a couple truck stops since then. Then COVID happens, and construction costs skyrocket, interest rates skyrocket. And, you know, we're based out of Southern Illinois. You know, our typical town is 3,000 to 7,000 people. And a lot of these mayors and people in these communities in these 3,000 people say, boy, I'd love to have a Mach 1. And, you know, in the 90s, that made sense. Now, what used to be a $1.5 million store is now an $8 million store. And your operating costs from everything has tripled. So, you know, you need a large customer base to offset the capital costs and the interest rate costs and the operation costs that's, you know, that's kind of set into a store no matter how big you are. So when we started identifying that, now it's just about maximizing profit centers, liquor being one of them, gaming being one of them, truck diesel being a big one. We're building two new stores as we speak. They're both truck diesel. I don't want to say that we would not build a traditional C store again, but that is not our roadmap. Our roadmap is to continue with what I call these mini travel centers. So 4 to 5 truck lanes, 25 to 35 truck parking spots, 3 showers, having the payment platform to offer all truck payments. The thing about the trucking customer is they are way more educated and way more demanding than the traditional C-store customer. You know, you think of a family of four. Dent, you talked about going to North Carolina recently. You know, if you and your wife and kids are driving down North Carolina and all of a sudden one of them has to use the restroom or you guys are hungry, you probably have made that decision on what exit to stop at 5 miles before you made your stop, maybe 15 miles. Well, a lot of our trucking customers made the decision to stop at us 3 days before they made their stop at us. And they may have been living, they may have been in Massachusetts when they said, hey, I'm going to go to that Mach 1 at this store. And you know what? If I offer them bad service, that's going to get taken off their list. So we have to execute that transaction and we have to take care of that customer every single time, because that is a demographic that all of our competitors are going very hard after. And then into the data and the software side of the trucking industry, I don't know how far down that rabbit hole you want to go, but trucking customers talk, and there's payment platforms that are out there today that all the trucking customers are aware of. The social media aspect, if a trucker has a bad experience, he's going to make sure everybody on that highway around him on that radio is aware of the bad experience he got. So we got to make sure that they're not talking about us when they're talking about bad experiences.
I would assume, you know, because of hours of service for truck drivers, you almost have a captive audience. So you really have to put that kind of best face forward for that customer.
You know, and that kind of coincides with food service. So we were not born from food service. You know, when you think about kind of the different ways C-stores have come to market and the different options they've got, I've always been a big proponent of adding square footage, not caring that it's a high capital cost, more caring about a low operational cost. Because if you have high revenue with a low operating cost, it's only a matter of time before you pay off the startup capital to do that. So car wash, I mean, we don't build a store without a car wash. Really high startup capital, really good margins. Doesn't really take a lot of labor to execute it. So you're going to make money every month and that will go towards that loan. Eventually you're going to be profitable. So we're big into the car wash. Liquor is a very similar model. Food service never fit into that model. Food service is low capital costs, ungodly high operating costs. And the history of our industry said you struggle to break even. So it never really made a lot of sense to me. But that's not an expectation our customers are going to allow at this point. And you are either in the food service industry or you're not a top tier truck stop or C-store. That's just the fact of life now. I got kind of dragged into it kicking and screaming, but we are on the deep end of the pool at this point. We got four Little Caesars. We got our proprietary food program today that is at the majority of our stores. If you want to talk about any one category I spend the majority of my time on, it is food service, because if you provide a poor product or offering there, that is a quicker way to lose your customer than anything else you can do.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, I was going to kind of follow this up as like, you know, how is it different developing a truck stop versus a convenience store? But you kind of just answered it for me anyway. There's still, despite the footprint, et cetera, there's still a lot of similarities.
There is. It's about 20 for us. It's about 25% increase in startup capital. You know, if we're building a truck stop, that's going to be about 25% more. And it really limits your opportunities because, you know, now you can only go right next to interstates, and you got to go to interstates that have enough truck demand and that isn't already, you know, when you think of a truck stop, I mean, the number really starts at 4 acres for us. You know, we'll go from 6 to 7 acres, but the number really starts at 4 acres for it to become a viable property. And so you got to find 4 undeveloped acres right next to an interstate that generally hopefully has some local population that you can pull from too. There is not a lot of those opportunities in a small geographic area. So, you know, for us, we're about to be at 25 stores. There really isn't going to be much more expanding up. We can't really stack on top of us if this is going to be the model. You know, you're only really going to build one truck stop in a market because there's typically only one interstate exit in a market type of thing. You got to expand out. So It is expanding your operations to support an ever expanding geography, while at the same time maintaining the same cultures, mentality, messaging that we did, that we talked about at the start of this podcast. I'm here to support you. We are in this together. You tell me what you need. For every store we built, that the bar you have to get to meet that standard gets harder and harder.
Yep. Yep. So, okay, now we're going to just hit you with some kind of rapid fire questions for the last 5 minutes or so here. But, yo, one thing our Opus data is telling us is that demand is down. 2019 was probably the peak. You know, how do you work around that shifting sort of demand environment that we're currently in?
Yeah, demand is down, and demand specific to our state is even worse than that. You know, we've had the worst population decline in the United States in the last 4 years. We now have, again, the second highest fuel tax. So if you're in interstate traveling, typically you're going to find a cheaper price on whatever other state you're going into. So, you know, we even have an uphill battle compared to what you're describing. And to me, it's about, you know, actually it was a, I was at a conference that you were speaking at, Den, that we talked to, obviously. And one of the biggest, actually the biggest thing I took away from what you made in your speaking was for 2019 up until recently, it was all about trying to figure out capturing margin to offset operation costs. Now it's about market share. And that really hit home to me that, you know, during COVID, nobody knew what the price was of anything. We didn't know what our operational costs were. I mean, it changed every month. Product costs were going through the roof. Equipment costs were going through the roof. We were giving out raises like, you know, constantly. I felt like I was giving somebody a raise every week. So what our wage cost is going to be was really fluid. And so you saw a lot of price increases, not only in our industry, but across all industries. The consumer today is, you know, I think they're in kind of in for a whirlwind. They had no idea what the price of gas or Snickers or a breakfast sandwich or a fountain soda was, because everybody's changing constantly. Those days are done. They are way more adept and conscientious and looking at pricing today. So trying to capture losing demand by gaining margin, I think that's a losing battle right now. I think the consumer is not going to let you just continue to raise prices. In fact, we've started lowering pricing and getting more aggressive with our sale prices to get that, to try to recapture market share based off of what you told me the last time we talked. I think you're right when you said it. It's you've got a lower consumer base, fuel demand's down. So the only way to maintain or grow sales is to capture more market share. So that's exactly what we're doing as we speak.
We can kind of continue to hear that narrative or that theme around, hey, we're starting to benchmark our forecourt performance versus market share, not towards year-over-year fuel volume, or, you know, 2 years ago fuel volume or something like that. It's really that shift around, hey, you know, what's our market share look like? You know, it's not, hey, this station did, you know, 15,000 gallons this week, but last week it did 17,000. You know, maybe we should think about a different pricing strategy here. You know, that has continued to come up at different parts of the country, and it's a theme that's starting to catch on pretty good.
Yeah, Brandon. And I think that, I mean, because I hear that too in our industry. And when you get peers in our industry talking about, you know, our fuel demand's down 6% or 2% or whatever it is. Well, if the market's down 3% or 4% and you're actually up 2% and you're making marketing and operational decisions thinking you are down 2% when in reality you're up 2%, well, you're making the wrong decisions because those decisions are based off the wrong information. So if you're just doing things like year over year sales, I can tell you right now, you're going to make the wrong decisions. You got to have access to more than just what your numbers are compared to your numbers over time. And what we have with you guys actually is my go-to. It is, to me, a market, how much fuel is an inelastic product. So however much fuel you sell, you're probably not going to convince somebody to drive just to burn fuel. So let's just say a market is capped at a gallon, at the number of gallons sold in that market. You're not going to convince people to increase those gallons. So now it's about chasing after the gallons that are available that may be going to one of your competitors.
Absolutely. Anything that we talked about today, anything that we didn't talk about today, what keeps you up at night?
Well, I think you guys just touched on it, shrinking demand. That's first and foremost. You know, we obviously there's alternative fuels available today, and that's going to continue to grow. I'm not going to pretend to think that I know the timeline that that's going to grow on. I do think that there's a place for our industry, no matter what that ultimately ends up being. We are still in the prime location and offering products that people offer independent of whether they're driving a combustible engine or not. So I'm not worried about the future of the industry, but what that looks like is my biggest concern. And how the messaging that we deliver is, hey, you know, I don't have to sit there and say what this industry is going to look like 10 years from now. I know this industry is going to be around, and you know, I could probably, with all the consolidation in our industry, I'm not going to do it, but I could basically name every one of my competitors on my one hand, and they're in the same markets I am. And so what I always say is, hey, let's not worry about what's going on from an industry standpoint 10 years from now. Let's make sure we're better than those five competitors. And if we're better than them, most of these guys are publicly traded companies. They're going to be profitable. They've got a business model. And if we sell more than them, we're going to be just fine. So that's kind of the mindset that we've done. But, you know, shrinking demands, number one, just volatility. I'm guessing I'm one of the most progressive retailers in our industry. I love change. I love technology. I love change. I love trying things. My gosh, it's gotten to the point where even I'm saying, man, it'd be great if we just put the brakes on this just a little bit, because it is now with AI and the software we're looking at now, where you throw things, data into an AI, and it's just spitting out answers for you. Holy cow. It is, it can become an avalanche on pace of change. And you can never take a breath on what you say, okay, this is the current state of the industry. Because by the time you go around telling people this is the current state of the industry, it's already changed by the time you've gotten done saying what you're going to say. So what is a normal, people are saying, like, how much do you make on gas? What's a normal margin? I always say, honestly, I have no idea what my normal margin is. 8 years ago, I could have told you pretty easily, but hell, it depends on the day of the week. It may change 30 cents over a 48-hour period. So who the heck knows anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at a future screen here right now, and gasoline futures, when we started talking, were up a penny and a half or so. They're down now. So it just speaks to that volatility. So we're running low on time, and I always want to end with just a random question. So, Alan, you're in Southern Illinois. So as I look at the map here, I think to your west, you have the Kansas City Chiefs. To your north, you have the Chicago Bears. And I believe you're pretty close to, Kentucky and Ohio. So the Cincinnati Bengals right there. Who's your team?
And the Indianapolis Colts are really close too.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't like any of those teams. Buffalo Bills for me, mainly because I love punishment. after they lost four straight Super Bowls, how could I give up on them after that?
That's right. Right, they're knocking on the doorstep, and they're going to bust down the door one of these days here, because they certainly have some talent.
Oh, man, I love Josh Allen. I just – his attitude and personality, and my God, that guy would run through a concrete wall if the end zone was on the other side of it. So, sign me up for that guy. I'll win or lose with that guy. So at the very least, Denton, I can tell you one thing's guaranteed. Josh Allen's going to make the game entertaining to watch. There's no doubt about that.
Sure. Yeah. Now, I could see a Mach 1 Josh Allen, collaboration here somewhere down the line.
I tell you what, if he's listening to this, you tell him, you give him my cell phone number, I will fly out and have that meeting with him anytime he wants.
Well, if this so happens, I will be glad to facilitate that. So
if he's worried about the current state of oil pricing in the season. <That's
right. laughs> Alan, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with Brendan and I. This has been great. You've always been a good friend to us, and I can't thank you enough and tell you how much we appreciate the relationship we have.
Oh, absolutely, Dan. I tell you, I mean, I've had a relationship with Opus, well, basically as long as I've been fortunate enough for my dad to give me a job here. So I think your guys is one of the first companies I ever started working with. And man, I could just list off so many people that I've worked with in your company. And I mean, it's all the support and experience that I've gotten. This has been fun. And I'm just a big believer in what you guys are doing over there.
Well, thanks again. And that's all the time we have for now. So we'll get back with you next time when Opus talks.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.